You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 18th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Jay cannot be with us tonight because
Why? He
is sick.
Aww.
Sick with what?
So he's been progressively losing his voice today. Now he basically can't talk. Of course, we were all together on Sunday, like for family Sunday dinner, and then he gets sick that night. So I'm just...
At the most contagious point in the sickness.
Yeah. I'm just waiting for the incubation period now.
He's so funny. Nice. He called me a half hour ago. And then he was saying how whenever he gets sick like this, he just does voices because his voice is so different than what it normally is. He just does these goofy voices. I was laughing my ass off.
More so.
So funny.
And so what is it? Do you think it's like laryngitis, pharyngitis, strep throat?
His doctor's treating him for strep throat based on his symptoms. They didn't do a culture or anything.
Gotcha.
And despite treatment, he's getting rapidly, progressively worse.
Oh, no.
Poor Jay.
Maybe it's not.
No.
I mean, whenever I used to get strep all the time, and it was so bloody obvious if I just looked at the back of my throat. It was just looked like it was flocked like a Christmas tree, which is very gross. Oh God, and strep hurts like hell. So I was, I follow this weird pathologist on Instagram and she posts pictures of just gross stuff. And she always does a disclaimer, like I only deal with dead bodies. I don't deal with living patients, but sometimes people send me pictures of their weird symptoms. And somebody had sent her a picture of a bucket full of these little hard, gross white nodules, and she does this mystery diagnosis thing where she'll post a picture and ask people what they think it is, and they were tonsil stones.
Tonsil
what?
Stones.
What? Do you guys heard of that?
They are disgusting. They're like these.
as disgusting as they sound.
They're as disgusting as they sound. They're these little things that collect and grow over time in like the crevices of your tonsils. And it's mostly just food and bacteria that grow and grow and grow because your tonsils, you know, are kind of like a net. Eventually, sometimes people will notice that they have them because they'll feel like there's a lump in their throat and you can kind of pick them out with a toothbrush or it's super gross. Like most people get them out themselves because it's really common. I've never had one, but I read about it all over the internet because I was intrigued. And a lot of times people don't know they have them until they get a bad cough and then they cough out all these little tonsilliths, they're also called.
Tonsilliths.
That's a great name for tonsilliths.
New ones are called tonsil neoliths.
Also, guys, if you do Google tonsil stone, do it with caution. Because there are some pretty brutal videos and pictures online of people's tonsil stones. But yeah, more than 200,000 cases per year, usually self-treatable, usually self-diagnosable, it says on WebMD, although I'm not sure how much I want to trust that.
How do you treat them? Just like reach in there with forceps and yank them out?
So what it says, you got to pull them out. It says most people can get them out on their own. If they see them and they spot them, they can use like a Q-tip. But if they're gagging too much or if they just can't reach them, then sometimes they have to go to like an ear, nose, and throat doctor and they can remove them. And then sometimes, apparently, if you get them chronically and you find that they do get infected, then that's when some people might recommend tonsillectomy. But oftentimes it says they're pretty like benign in the sense that they don't often get infected. Oh, and by the way, here's the fun thing. Guess what they call the crevices of your tonsils? They call them crypts.
Crypts?
Crypts?
These are crypt stones.
That's so gross.
Crypt stones. And Matt, get this. This is gross. Imagine spitting your tonsillus at people. Pew!
So a defense mechanism.
Yeah, so fun
times.
Wonder
if evolution had that planned for us.
The funny thing is there's probably a lot of people listening right now that are like, that's what those are.
Oh, my God. There's yes.
Because they.
All right, so what?
Yeah.
Are we telling people to send us pictures of their discharge so we can analyze it?
But they said a lot of times people don't realize they have them until they notice because they cause like bad breath, you know, it's bacteria that's caught in your tonsils. So they actually, when they do cough them up or they pull them out, the main thing they notice about them is that they smell really bad. Sorry for that image. Oof.
Gee.
Yikes.
Yeah, rotting stuff usually smells bad. It's a good rule of thumb.
Decay.
Nice fun topic to start off the day.
Just to start off our show lightly. Well, Bob, you're back this week with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's superhero of science, I am going to talk about Berute Galdikas. She is an anthropologist, primatologist, conservationist, and a few other ists. And she is also the leading authority on orangutans. I love reading her bio. She was at the age of six, she was inspired by the man in the yellow hat from the Curious George's book series to become an explorer. The course of her career, though, was set as a graduate student when she approached the famous Kenyan anthropologist, Dr. Lewis Leakey, about her wish to study orangutans. And he was skeptical at first, but ultimately he was convinced and he got her funding for her orangutan studies in Borneo. Now, this part is fascinating. This completed the trio of women that he called the trimates, which he had specifically handpicked to study humans' closest relatives, the great apes. So I'm sure you know these names. Jane Goodall studied chimpanzees. Diane Fossey studied mountain gorillas. And now there was Berute Galdikas, who studied orangutans. And he pretty much – I did not know this. Did you know, Steve, that he was instrumental in setting these women on their course that made them world famous? Berute has studied them now for over 40 years. In fact, she has led the longest unbroken study by an individual of any wild mammal in the world. I mean, 40 plus years. And people were telling her it couldn't be done. They're too reclusive. They're in these swamps. They're not going to tolerate your presence. And she proved them all wrong. So she initially brought these beautiful animals to the world's attention for the first time in the mid-70s when she got a cover article on National Geographic. I think she's had two altogether now. But she didn't only tremendously expand what's known about these creatures. She also has worked tirelessly to preserve their habitats, which, of course, is critical, but especially considering that even despite her work, the poaching and habitat destruction has brought their populations dangerously close to extinction. I didn't know it was quite that bad. In fact, some people predict that they could be gone outside of wild preserves, of course, within 20 years. Within 20 years, we may not have hardly any wild orangutans anymore. That is scary as hell. Imagine what their state would be now if it weren't for her efforts. So remember Berute Mary Galdikas? Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing primates that eat dirt and rocks and can blow raspberries.
They can blow raspberries?
Because, yes. Yeah, so, come on. You've seen the movie with what's his name?
Oh, Clyde.
Clyde. Yeah, Clyde. Of course. Yeah. I think that's something that they can just do, either easily trained or just kind of on their own. But they also can sometimes eat dirt and rocks. Nice.
Clyde was a female. You know how you know?
How do you know? Oh, the pads. The face pad? Yeah.
The males store fat in their face. Mm-hmm. And so they get these big, huge faces where the females don't. Yeah.
So at the LA Zoo, we have a really beautiful orangutan exhibit, and there's one female orangutan there named Eloise, who was born in 1968. She's been there for 46 years. She's a mom, and she has a disorder that's like cerebral palsy. So she's really interesting. She sits very close to the glass. She loves people. She can't move very easily, so she'll just lie there all day and look you in the eyes and like hold her hand up to the glass. And even despite that, they've worked really hard to make sure that she's happy and healthy, and she's a really good mom. And I love going to visit her.
Oh, tell her I said hi.
I will.
So good news, everyone.
Good news.
Have you guys heard?
No, what?
What?
The Department of Justice is going after
the seller
of supplements who are, you know, engaged in false advertising and violating the rules. It's actually been a really good year for in terms of regulating supplements and homeopathy.
A banner year, geez.
Yeah, yeah. And not just in the U.S., in the U.K., this is partly due to we actually interviewed Simon Singh about this at TAM. We played it last week. That the Good Thinking Society, through their efforts, got the NIH to re-examine their coverage of homeopathic prescriptions through general practitioners. So they may be on the chopping block. But in the U.S., there's been a slew of things. I'm not sure why that is. It's actually interesting. For example, the FDA is reviewing their regulation of homeopathy.
Yeah, we heard that earlier.
The FTC is reviewing their regulation of homeopathy as well.
Nice.
Good.
And just for background, the FDA, is the Food and Drug Administration, they regulate food, drugs, and supplements. The FTC is the Federal Trade Commission. They regulate advertising, so they could go after them for false advertising. And then, of course, the Department of Justice is getting involved now, and they go after people when what they do rises to the level of criminal, you know, warrants criminal charges.
Yeah, serious stuff.
Yeah, so it's getting serious. So recently, the Department of Justice issued a statement. They are indicting the USP Labs, which sold a workout supplement called Jack 3D, and six of its executives face criminal charges.
Wow.
For the unlawful sale of nutritional supplements.
Mm. Wow, what a precedent that could be.
Yeah, but listen to what they did to deserve that, allegedly, right?
Because yeah.
This is what they allegedly did.
I'm sure it's bad.
They were told by the FDA that one of their products was linked to liver damage and, in fact, resulted in people requiring liver transplants.
Whoa.
Ooh, wow.
So they said, we'll pull that off the shelves right away. But what they allegedly did instead was that they quickly sold off their existing stocks.
Oh, no.
What's how scumbag?
Could you imagine?
Slimy. Oh,
scum
my God.
Of the earth.
No.
They sold product they knew was linked to liver failure, sort of just like, and lied about it, and then tried to hide up the fact that they did it. I mean, really, really. The epitome of corporate malfeasance, you know?
That's crazy.
And it just, it reinforces this idea. I think a lot of times when we talk about supplements, we talk about kind of, oh, they just don't work. You know, it's like, it's expensive piss is what you hear a lot from skeptics.
Yeah. Right.
But sometimes they can actually have negative consequences like this.
So the problem is that the current regulation in a lot of countries, including the U.S., lumps herbs and vitamins together into one category. Sometimes there's like the category is natural products. In the U.S., it's supplements. But supplements, you know, scientifically, those are nutritional things, right? Like vitamins, minerals, micronutrients. Mm-hmm. Herbs are not supplements. You don't take them for the nutritional value. Herbs are drugs. They're basically drugs that are regulated like food. After 1996, companies could essentially market supplements and herbs as supplements with these pseudo health claims, these structure function claims, without any FDA oversight. They don't have to show any evidence for safety or effectiveness. They're assumed to be safe. Again, they can make these health claims without any evidence, burden of proof. The FDA gets involved when they are adulterating their products with drugs, which many of them do, in which case the FDA sends them off a very sternly worded letter requesting them to stop doing that.
And they never do.
Well, half the time. Don't say never.
Oh, is it half? Okay.
A recent study found that a year later, only half of the companies that had adulterated their supplements with actual drugs, you know, like putting Viagra in your male enhancement supplement.
Yeah.
For example, or putting stimulants in your
diet
supplement.
Which ones do that?
You're right. Hang on, spell that.
After a year, half of them were still doing it. They just completely ignored the FDA requests.
Oof.
Yeah.
And does this also include like, quote, homeopathic water, sugar pills, things like that?
No, homeopathy, those are
grandfathered,
regulated as drugs by the FDA.
Yep.
They're not supplements and herbs, they're drugs. But the FDA essentially 50 years ago decided to just not bother regulating them because it was so small an industry. So they allowed the homeopathic industry to regulate itself.
Oh, geez. And that's why on the bottle, like homeopathy just says this is a homeopathic product. And then actual herbs and supplements have that little disclaimer that says these statements not evaluated by the FDA.
Right. Yeah, they're just different regulations. So that's why the FDA is now saying, oh, this is now ballooned into a multi-billion dollar industry. It's no longer this tiny fringe thing that we ignored 50 years ago. Maybe we should take another look at this.
They actually have
the authority to require evidence of efficacy prior to allowing a homeopathic remedy on the market. Mm-hmm. In a single stroke, the FDA could essentially wipe out the homeopathy industry.
Haven't they looked at the existing body of evidence and realized right now that there's no evidence whatsoever?
I suspect they know that, and it's just a matter of the political will.
Political
do
will.
They want the, do they want the fight? And are senators going to come to the rescue of the homeopathy
industry? Do they have big lobbyists? Like, who knows how many, you know, individual legislators are actually kind of on the payroll?
Yeah, of course they do. Multi-billion dollar industry, by definition, is going to have lobbyists.
Steve, I wanted to say that the liver scam guys.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, they're scumbags and they're being, you know, they're being brought up on criminal charges and that's great. But I actually find that a little bit disappointing that it takes such an egregious, overt act to warrant something like that. Whereas there are other people that aren't making people have organ transplant surgeries that also, I think, should be brought up on criminal charges. And I'm afraid they're going to get their hands slapped.
I agree with that. But so that's, so there's, I see it as three levels, right? And when I wrote about this on science-based medicine, I said there's three levels here. The first level is the regulation itself is inadequate. Even when companies 100% comply with the regulation, they're still allowed to sell what are essentially worthless products with these pseudo health claims.
Right.
Americans have spent billions of dollars a year
in recent years
for nothing. They're getting no value for their money. They're just getting random crap in a bottle that you could make any claims for. There's no incentive to actually formulate something that works. There's no incentive to do any research because you don't have to. Well, the claims and placebo effects are enough. They're making billions of dollars a year off of placebos, essentially. The second level is when they violate those regulations by doing things like substitution, contamination, adulteration with drugs, you know, just poor quality control type of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's rampant as well, as we talked about previously on the show. And now, like, for example, the New York State's attorney is getting involved with that, and that's coming under a lot of attention as well. The third level is this type of flagrant criminal behavior, you know, like knowingly selling drugs that are causing liver damage just to get rid of your existing stock. I mean, that's just terrible. So I definitely think that this, you know, this will spark outrage and will crack down on that level of things. But the industry will say, yeah, that's a few bad apples. Yeah, throw them under the bus. I'm also concerned that even if the second tier of like adulteration contamination, if that gets a lot of attention, I mean, obviously that needs to be fixed. But if that gets fixed, you're still left with the first tier of an industry selling fake products, basically, with fake claims. And I don't want everyone to think that it's only the second and third tier that are the problem. You know,
the first tier might be the biggest.
Yeah, it's huge. The first tier is, I think, the biggest problem, and we have to make sure that we use this opportunity to fix that. I also think that, listen, when you create an opening for an industry that allows people to sell fake products with fake claims, you shouldn't be surprised when it attracts a bunch of scumbags, right? It just shouldn't surprise anybody that the people who are selling these products might not have the greatest ethics, you know?
Yeah, because there is that difference. You know, we always talk about it in the skeptic community, the difference between the people who are kind of themselves duped and are buying into the hype and the people who are just full-on self-aware charlatans.
Right.
Right.
And there's got to be a huge percentage of those people involved behind the scenes when it comes to basically selling vapor.
Right. It's going to attract con artists and charlatans. It's going to attract it. When you don't have effective regulation, you don't have a science-based standard, con artists are going to come out of the woodwork, and that's what we've seen happening. And not to say that everyone selling a supplement's a con artist. Some may actually believe, but they're not being held to any standard. So,
and also, it's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff there too, because there are, you know, there is some evidence that certain types of things that aren't necessarily evaluated by the FDA at this point may have some efficacy, right? Like I've known, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I've known psychiatrists to recommend St. John's wort before recommending, for example, an SSRI.
So that's a little bit complicated. So St. John's wort has MAO inhibitors in it. It has drugs in it, drugs that we know to be antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that when you buy pills of a St. John's wort off the shelf, you have no idea what you're getting. You have no idea if you're getting what's on the label. You don't know what the dose is. There's drug-drug interactions, serious drug-drug interactions.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the biggest ones you read
about.
Yeah,
we don't use MAO inhibitors much anymore because they're lousy, dirty drugs.
Yeah, we usually use SSRIs.
That's what you're getting in St. John's wort. So even when the studies show that an herb may have some efficacy, in the studies, they are making sure that they're using DNA-proven, you know, pure product. Mm-hmm. You cannot generalize that research to the industry because the industry isn't regulated to that degree. You don't know that what you're getting off the shelf is equivalent to what was studied in those clinical trials. So it's worthless.
I assume you have a similar problem with things like melatonin that actually, like you said, have some efficacy for certain reasons but aren't regulated.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's rough. That's really extra confusing because then we're talking about vapor versus individual compounds that aren't dosed well that actually could be potentially harmful and they're
dirty,
all in the
poorly
same
regulated
bucket.
Drugs.
Yeah.
Oof. Some of them may work, but the industry is too poorly regulated for it to be useful to the consumer. It's just risk. And again,
beneficial. Yeah.
As much as they might work, they also can cause harm, as like, you know, liver and kidney damage drugs. These are drugs. They have all the same risk for toxicity as any other drug. Their only saving grace is that their doses generally are low, or their bioavailability is generally low. So they may be more towards the worthless rather than dangerous end of the spectrum, but that's hardly much of a saving grace. And then even then, there are some that are going to cause toxicity.
So can I ask you how you feel about vitamin C? I'm definitely interested now. I'm so roped into this because every internist, every family care doctor that you run into when you start to get sick will be like, well, just, you know, make sure you take your vitamin C.
Yeah, that's
well. If you have scurvy,
that's just
I guess
to give you something to do. I mean, seriously, we've had 50 years of research now, and it hasn't really shown any significant benefit from vitamin C acutely for a cold or even in prevention. Yeah, at best, you know, you get this slight effect, which is imperceptible to an individual user. And when you get to effect sizes that small, you know, like if over a 7-day illness, you may shave an hour off of your cold symptoms. I mean, just
negligible.
It's negligible. So it's a point where it's not clinically significant. And when you get down to that level, that's just noise. And that's just little bit of publication bias will give you that little bit of residue
of an
effect.
Error bars right there.
Yeah, it's the error bars. It's not a real effect, in my opinion. Or it's indistinguishable from a non-existent effect. So, but it's in the culture and just people believe it. I think. You know, I do criticize my colleagues who deviate from being rigorously science-based when they think it's harmless. The current regulations, which were written by Harkin and Hatch, you know, both sides of the aisle, totally pro-industry, anti-consumer, completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
They know how to appeal to both liberal and conservative ideologies, you know, to liberals,
bipartisan.
You're talking to liberal politicians. It's, you know, all about the natural remedies and the hippie stuff. And when you're talking to conservatives, it's, you know, we don't need the government on industry. It's free markets. Right. Like the free market sorted out freedom. Yeah. Both sides talk about freedom, but it's sort of from a slightly different perspective. There is no political party for the scientific approach, though.
Damn shame.
There's now multiple things happening, you know, with the FDA, the FTC, and also now the Department of Justice.
DOJ,
Keep tabs on this. Hopefully something concrete will come out of it. I also...
Like jail sentences.
I actually don't know if I'm supposed to talk about this or not, but I was actually contacted by the staff of a very prominent senator, federal U.S. senator, who is looking at this issue very seriously. And they interviewed me about like what they should do. What should the position be? What are all the problems with current regulation? Yeah.
How'd they get your name, I wonder?
From science-based medicine.
All right. Congress is paying attention a little bit. Well, someone.
Yeah, I remember with Oz, they were clearly like almost quoting you guys.
She knew what time it was. Oh, yeah. It was obvious. It was obvious that they were informed by what we were writing.
Very cool.
All right. Well, Kara, tell us about armadillos and leprosy.
I'm so excited about this one. So what do you guys know about leprosy?
Everything.
Oh, let's see. In that movie, The Ten Commandments, let's see. And towards the end, and there were these people, and they were lepers, and they had like sores all over their body and limbs falling off.
Limbs falling off, right? That's something that we always think about. And I think we also always think about the Bible. When we think leprosy, we think it's leopards, like a biblical scourge, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Jesus cured the lepers, all that.
I can tell you what I learned in medical school.
And so do you actually learn about leprosy in medical?
We're talking about the Bible here. Come on.
That's great that you do, because as we know, it's pretty rare, but it still exists.
It
and
still
I think
exists,
it's important to remember that it still exists. So it's also called Hansen's disease, which I think does something to help erase some of that biblical stigma around it.
Yeah.
You know, when somebody gets diagnosed with Hansen's disease, that's a little bit easier to take than leprosy. So if you read about that, know that those things are synonymous. And it was actually first described like 1500 years before the Common Era. So it's super, super old. There's evidence that individuals had it. It was written on Egyptian papyrus way back then. And although it is really rare, it still infects about 2 million people across the world.
Whoa.
And just around 6,000 or so in the U.S. There are about 200 new cases of leprosy every year in the United States. So it makes you think, well, how does this happen? Like, what causes leprosy? And Steve knows this. Is it viral or is it bacterial?
It's a bacteria.
It is. It's a bacterium. It's called Mycobacterium leprae. And there's also a secondary bacterium that can that causes it, Mycobacterium lepromatosis, which was identified much later. Mycobacterium leprae was first identified in 1873 in Norway by, you guessed it, Dr. Hansen, a.k.a. Hansen's disease.
Right, of course.
There you go. And lepromatosis, M. lepromatosis, was described in Texas. And when we think about how people, you know, these 200 new cases in the United States specifically, get it each year, A, they can get it from each other, and B, they can get it from armadillos.
Oh my God. Wow.
Armadillos.
WTF.
All creatures.
So we've known this for a long time, but
yeah,
it's still
weird.
Yeah,
I learned that in medical school.
Yeah. So it's like, it's funny. It's
that armadillos are carriers.
It's a well-documented thing, but a lot of people, it's just not part of our general knowledge. So it is a zoonotic infection. We've talked about zoonotic infections before. These are infections that have an animal reservoir that then will periodically spill over into the general population. So almost by definition, zoonotic infections can't be wiped out, because even if you will, you can treat a little spillover event, there's always a chance that somebody else is going to get that spillover again. This is what happens with Ebola, right? But Ebola is a zoonotic virus. So there's a spillover event. It spreads very quickly. Even once we get that Ebola under control, it may pop up again in 5 years, 10 years. You know, who knows? It kind of lays in wait. So this is a zoonotic infection that actually hangs out in armadillos. And there's a new CDC report. This is where the news peg comes in the Journal of Emerging Infectious Diseases, that details two important findings that just occurred recently. One, the incidence of leprosy may actually be on the rise, but don't get too scared. I'll explain why. And two, there was a previously undiscovered genetic variant that tested to be present. The very common variant is called M. leprae genotype 31-2-V1. And they found that in a large number of armadillos that were tested. And then they also found that in a human population that was tested. But they found a new variant called M. leprae 31-2-V15, which had never been described by science before. And that actually is important for some of the ramifications of this study. So one, leprosy may be on the rise. Two, there's a new genetic variant that nobody's seen before in the literature. But don't freak out, because even though these things make for really good headlines, and you will likely see previously unknown leprosy detected, leprosy on the rise, be careful, you're going to catch leprosy. Let's talk about the reasons why this is not something that you should freak out about. One, as Steve learned in medical school, leprosy is not that contagious at all. And the reason for that is that 95% of the human population is immune.
Whoa.
Well, that's true. But even aside from that, even if you're not immune, it just is really has a very low infectivity. Usually you only get it from somebody that you live with for a long time.
Yeah, it's hard to transmit.
Yeah,
and
very
it's
hard
also
to transmit.
Even once you get it, it's really slow growing. So let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. The leprosy bacteria divides once every 2 weeks. Compare that to E. coli, which we always hear about in the news, you know, E. coli spinach, E. coli, whatever. People get these E. coli infections, obviously from poo. It's poo bacteria. That divides once every 17 minutes. Once every 2 weeks, once every 17 minutes. You can do the math and see how quickly your infection can become difficult for you to fight. Yeah, so it can take 4 to 8 years before patients even show symptoms after they've been infected. And the other thing that can, you know, put the brakes on the freak out machine here is that it's totally curable. This is a bacterial infection. We have antibiotics. And even though leprosy did develop antibiotic resistance like way back in the 1960s, physicians have found the multi-drug cocktail that works really well. And in fact, starting in 1995, the World Health Organization offers free leprosy drugs, three of them, free of charge to anyone who needs them. So if you get leprosy, you can reach out to the World Health Organization and you can actually get those drugs. So don't be freaked out, even though it sounds like this scary biblical scourge. It actually was a scourge back then because we didn't have the medicine to treat it. And so I think the question here is like, why should you care? Why is this research relevant? Why did I choose to talk about this as my story this week? Well, one, if you live in the southern United States, you have a small but real risk of getting leprosy. It's only 5% of the general population that can even get it. But if you eat armadillos, which some people do, I know it sounds crazy.
Yeah, if you hunt and eat armadillos, that's really a big risk.
It's a big risk. Or if you handle them, if you work in some sort of wildlife preserve, or you are a farmer who often encounters them and you're handling armadillos, there is a legitimate risk that you could be infected. So that's something to keep an eye out. This is, you know, more common in historically all the studies were done in Texas and Louisiana, but we're now seeing cases cropping up as far east as Florida. So we are seeing that geographical location is growing and that the number of infected individuals also seems to be growing. This also applies if you live in, you know, India or other regions across the world that have active leprosy outbreaks. There is a real risk to getting it, even though it's very, very, very small. Now, the other thing that I think is an important takeaway from this new study is that researchers are cautioning that, you know, zoonotic infections can develop new spillover events without any sort of warning. So, when there's a new genetic variant that's detected, we don't know anything about it. If this bacteria did evolve in such a way to have a new genotype, it could potentially become an infectious agent for another type of animal. If leprosy starts to spill over, not just from humans to armadillos and from armadillos to humans, but let's say from armadillos to, I don't know, let's pick a random animal, raccoons or squirrels, okay, you could see what kind of a downstream effect that could potentially have. And that is an open-ended question. This is something that we see with viral spillovers that can be a lot more detrimental, like bird flu, swine flu, where they develop a spillover event in a new kind of organism. And so there's a whole new host of organisms that's never been exposed to it before. Researchers do think that the reason that armadillos are good carriers of leprosy is because their core body temperature is a little bit lower. And if you notice, leprosy tends to focus on the parts of the body that are colder. So you'll see this leprosy infection manifest on the tip of the nose, the fingertips, the toes,
the extremities,
the external genitalia. These are places where sometimes you'll see these downstream, if it goes untreated, these horrible kind of effects of leprosy. And there could be some connection there between the body temperature in armadillos and the body temperature of our extremities. So that's also an interesting little nugget that you can sort of share around the water cooler. You know, when the conversation of leprosy comes up at work, which you know it will now, tomorrow.
I was definitely intrigued because it's the iconic disease in terms of being contagious, you know, it's like the iconic contagion. But in fact, it's one of the, if not the least contagious disease in the world, you know.
I love that. Yeah. And it's not just because we have good treatments. It's also because of so many other factors.
Yeah.
It's hard to catch. It's slow to develop. So all of these things combined just show you how much minimal advances in hygiene and minimal advances in medical treatment really flip the script on what historically was a real scourge.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, tell us how the sun is stripping the atmosphere off Mars.
It's been a longstanding mystery of Mars, and it's now been solved. It looks like that the minimal atmosphere of Mars was caused by the sun's solar wind, which drained it away over millions of years. So like I said, this was one of the big mysteries of Mars, and that mystery kind of revealed itself very quickly as soon as it became clear that this planet once had liquid water on its surface, oceans of it, in fact. And that's been abundantly clear for many, many years now. There's just too much evidence that in its history, there was liquid water and even current evidence of some sort of hydrated salts or something like that. So the fact that there was water on the surface, that obviously implies that it was once a much warmer place and had a much thicker atmosphere. Yet today, look at it. It's cold, it's barren, it's dusty, and its atmosphere is about 1/100 as thick as the Earth's. I found a interesting way to illustrate that. Some guy was saying that if you look at Mount Everest on Earth, the highest point on Earth, we're talking 4.9 pounds per square inch atmospheric pressure. But if you go to the lowest place on Mars, and that's called Hellas Planitia, which is 23,500 foot deep crater, it's just 0.168. So it's like 29 times as thick if you can compare the tallest point on Earth to the deepest point on Mars. And so it's really negligible. So something clearly happened to Mars's atmosphere, but what was it? So there's been a lot of theories going around. Some people were saying that the atmospheric gases were locked away in the rocks through some chemical reactions similar to how carbon dioxide is sequestered in the geology of the Earth. Perhaps there was some titanic impact in the past on Mars that ripped away its atmosphere. That's a possibility. Or perhaps the atmosphere was lost to space for maybe one of two reasons. The low gravity of Mars, it's only a third the mass, and or solar wind from the sun. Now, the gravity hypothesis, that wasn't especially tenable, I think. The gravity is 1/3 Earth, and that should be enough to hold on to much more atmosphere than there's now. But these other hypotheses, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. They could have all contributed in some way. And that still may be possible, even with this latest news. But NASA now believes that the primary reason for the loss of Mars's atmosphere has to do with something called MAVEN, or the information came about because of MAVEN. Now, MAVEN is NASA's Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution mission probe that arrived in 2014, and it began studying the atmosphere of Mars. And it found...
Yeah, that's the rocket that I saw launch.
Oh, awesome. So MAVEN found that 100 grams or 1/4 pound of ionized atmosphere is being lost to space every second due to the solar wind. That's not a lot in terms, if you've got a big atmosphere, 1/4 pound, even at 1 per second isn't a lot, but it's kind of like, I try to think of an analogy. It's kind of like Jay's son Dylan coming to my house and stealing just one or two of my pirate coins during each visit. And then before you know it, after about 100 Halloweens, he's got my entire pirate booty. It's all gone.
He's 100 years old and still taking your coins.
So how does this happen? The actual process was interesting. The sun's solar wind consists of countless charged electrons and protons and traveling at 1,000,000 miles per hour. So they are speedy as hell. And the magnetic field of the solar wind generates an electric field when it strikes the atmosphere. And what that does is that can accelerate electrically charged atoms in the atmosphere, causing them to fly off into space. So that's the process. But actually, that's only part of the story. MAVEN also had the good luck to witness a major solar storm hitting Mars while it was doing its observations. And during that time, the loss of atmosphere increased by 2,000%. So 20 times the amount was going. So that was a pretty hefty increase. So that's kind of like Dylan and a bunch of his delinquent toddler buddies occasionally pilfering my coins all at the same time. So therefore, the constant pummeling of Mars' atmosphere by the solar wind with the intermittent wallops by the solar storms can more than explain its current diminished state. The next question is, well, hey, why didn't the Earth suffer the same fate? And there's one reason for that. What is it, guys?
Our magnetic field.
The magnetosphere.
The magnetic field, yeah. I got that one. So,
you totally knew that,
Karen.
Yes.
Yeah, totes.
So, yeah, this protective planetary force field, it not only protects us from space radiation, but it also protects our atmosphere itself. Now, Mars had a magnetosphere, we believe, but we think the core cooled and solidified, which stopped the formerly liquid iron from continuing to generate one. And actually, I didn't know this, there's actually tiny little bubbles of remnant magnetic fields scattered on Mars, but they're not enough for any real protection at all.
Right. They're localized. But
whoa. So wait, they're not just little magnets. They're physical little bubbles of magnetic field where like your compass would go apeshit on Mars.
Yeah, I think
that's awesome.
I would guess if you just had one, it wouldn't be mm-hmm. doing much. And then when you went into these specific areas, you'd be like, oh yeah, I'm going to start doing stuff now. But even if you were right in the middle of one, I still don't think it would help too much.
Yeah.
So the ramifications are kind of interesting. There are some people that, had hoped that we could more easily, you know, reconstitute at least part of Mars's atmosphere through terraforming, you know, by releasing the sequestered atmospheric gases that are in the rocks, which would make it relatively easy. Now, of course, we'd have to kind of bring it there or somehow manufacture it instead of just releasing it. Be free. So that's not going to happen. And also, this greatly reinforces the importance of the magnetosphere itself for surface life, at least life that requires some kind of planetary atmosphere in order to exist. So without a magnetosphere, you could pretty well guess that after, you know, a few hundred million years, that atmosphere will likely be completely diminished to a negligible amount. So MAVEN solved the mystery, and now we know what happened to the atmosphere. And of course, when the atmosphere started going, then of course any surface water that was on Mars just evaporated away in the low pressure. So that kind of explains what happened to the water mm-hmm. and the atmosphere. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even if we do terraform it and create an atmosphere, even if it only lasts for a million years, that's enough.
That's plenty, absolutely.
That's plenty for our civilization.
Oh, I totally agree. We can give it little kicks every century or so. So sure, that's not a problem. A
couple nuclear explosions.
Oh my god! Right? What was it? Elon Musk.
I like the crashing asteroids into the planet to release volatiles.
Yeah.
That's a good plan. We got to do all of that before you start building cities there.
Oh, yeah. Nanotech. Just make about it.
Doesn't sound expensive at all.
Make a billion, quadrillion little nanites that do what you wanted to do, and you're good to go.
And not do what you don't want to do.
In 6 months.
Yeah, uh-oh.
And it won't take centuries.
In 6 months.
But then you have to, like, then you got to, like, breathe all that stuff in. Nanotech is small.
Yeah, what's your point? Yes, I know.
You'd be biologically inert.
You could just program some sort of nanite apoptosis so that they just kill themselves.
Wow.
And you're good
to
go.
I love it. Nanopoptosis. Yes. Yes. Oh my gosh. We just coined a term.
Until they become aware of what's going on and they decide to turn that mechanism off.
No, guys, nanopoptosis is going to be my word next week.
Oh, good. At least I'll know that one.
So, Evan, I understand our friend Michael Horn is at it again.
Yeah, Michael Horn. We've talked about him before. But for those of you who don't know,
like Michael. Me.
Well, Kara, Michael Horn is the North American publicist for this gentleman named Edward Albert Billy Meyer. And for the rest of this news item, I'll refer to him as Billy Meyer.
Do you know who Billy Meyer is, Kara?
I might be Googling him right now.
UFO or. Strings.
He's the Swiss farmer
who
has been hoaxing contacts with UFOs for years and has made some famously horrible hoax UFO pictures and videos.
Right. Oh, yes. I'm looking at all of them right now. This is so fun. There will be a photographic background to this whole story.
My favorite is the flying saucer on a string. Yeah.
It was right out of Plan 9 from outer space.
So bad.
They're so good, bad.
Or the wedding cake looking thing and sitting on top of a garbage can lid. And that's what passes it as evidence of an alien spaceship.
And one of the doohickeys had clearly fallen off and landed on a lower part of the model.
Oh, this is so good, you guys.
He also is the one who took a picture of the television set and then claimed that the actresses on the TV were aliens who were contacting him.
Oh, my.
Oh.
Really?
He also has a bitchin' beard.
He was Duck Dynasty before there was Duck Dynasty. Let's just
For
put it
sure.
that way.
Yeah, he set a trend here.
As Steve said, it's a hoax. I call it a unsophisticated hoax. It is so flimsy.
It's childish.
Yeah, it really is. But like many fantasies, they impress children and some adults, such as Michael Horn. Michael Horn runs a website called They Fly. Horns.com. Yes, they do. And this past weekend on Horns' website, he took some time out to recognize the horrors of the terrorist attacks that occurred in Paris this past week. And he informed his audience that it was Billy Meier who predicted these terrorist attacks back in 1958. Mm-hmm. Yep, 57 years ago. So here is what Michael Horn wrote. Should there be any question about the specific prophetic accuracy in Billy Meier's warning about Islamic terrorism, it should be noted that in 1958, Meier stated the following. And it will be that fanatical Islamists carry out bloody revenge on the distant descendants of the Christians for their earlier crusades when they accomplish their deadly and destructive acts through irrepressible terror all over the world.
Right.
How many other people are like, yeah, there are some extremists in Islam that are just going to get worse?
Absolutely.
Like, it's not that prophetic. I mean, it is prophetic, but like, he's not alone in his prophecy.
Well, like, it's vague, you know, it's
yes, that's
Nostradamus-esque. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like, yeah, you couldn't find an event over 60 years that sort of loosely fits what you said. And he's, you know, he's now, of course, he's crowing. He's actually sent me an email with a link to his blog.
Uh-huh.
Saying, like, take that, skeptics. Now what do you say? I say you're an idiot is what I say. But, yeah, it's just, he says, well, you ignore our warnings at your peril. What warnings? How could this information possibly have been put to any use?
Right.
Something bad is going to happen in the future. Look.
It's not a prediction. It's nothing.
It's nothing, yeah.
Michael Horn says this is, and these are his words, this is inescapable in-your-face evidence of the accuracy and the unimaginably altruistic intentions of Billy Meier to forewarn humanity of the looming, mainly man-made dangers of society.
Yeah.
So, yeah. He could be writing for The Onion, practically.
Yeah.
It's almost parody.
It's beyond parody. Yeah, it's so bad.
Yep. No specifics. You know, I mean, come on, give us something. ISIS, ISIL, say something. These prophecies, here's what they all have in common. Nostradamus, Billy Meier, Edgar Cayce, all of them.
How about Paris? You know, just mention Paris would be nice, you know.
I'll wrap it up with this, because I did take a quick look to see which other psychics perhaps are taking claim for having predicted these terrorist attacks in Paris. And the one that's being talked about the most is Psychic Nikki. Psychic Nikki comes up usually around the new year when we talk about predictions. She, in fact, did. She said a terrorist attack in Paris, France. She predicted this for 2015. It is on her list. Also, also on her list is terrorist attack in Washington, D.C., terrorist attack in London, England, terrorist attack in Denver, Colorado, terrorist attack in Melbourne, Australia, terrorist attack in Boston, terrorist attack in Chicago, and about 400 other terrorist attacks, naming yeah. all the major cities of the world. So again, it's not a prediction when you go ahead right. and make a statement like that to include every possible city on the planet. That is not a prediction either. So sorry, Psychic Nikki, you fail as well.
Something bad will happen. That's basically.
Oh my God.
Somewhere in the world, likely where people live.
Right. Yes.
I'm good
my
at
gosh.
This.
All right. So no Who's That Noisy this week. Jay will get us caught up next week.
So
we're going to go straight, Kara, to Ooh. What's the word?
Yeah.
What's the word this week, you guys? The word is albedo.
Oh, yeah.
Good word. The people who have white skin and white hair
and white libidos. You know,
and pink eyes. No, that's albino.
Wrong. That's albino.
Yeah, so, but you stumbled onto something very good there, Evan.
Did I?
And of course, yes, you did. And of course, Bob is like, oh, yes, because this seems like a very Bob-like word. I feel like Bob definitely knows albedo. It's probably part of his lexicon.
Very astronomical.
Very astronomical. And I wanted to sort of keep in this theme that I'm sure I'm going to drop this week, but only because I had an urging from a couple of people of like words that sort of sound dirty, but aren't like albedo. It's not dirty.
Oh, the libido.
Yeah. So albedo is a noun. And in general, it just refers to the intensity of light that's reflected from an object. So how much light is that object reflecting back into the atmosphere? It's often measured as a coefficient or ratio on a scale from zero, meaning that there's no reflection at all. That's like a completely black surface, to one, which would be a pure white surface that would reflect back 100% of the radiation it encounters. Because, of course, white light includes all of the different colors of the visible light.
Well, would an albedo of one be something that's white, or would it be a mirror?
Both.
Both would.
Isn't that weird? Both would have an albedo of one, but only if it's like a very, very good mirror or something that is the purest kind of white.
Yeah.
Yeah. In astronomy, it's used to talk about that ratio that's often reflected by either a planet, a satellite, or any celestial body. So even though it broadly refers to light reflected off of an object, in astronomy, we almost always talk about an albedo as relating to a planetary body or a celestial body. In meteorology, we're often talking about the Earth's surface or the atmosphere. So the albedo of certain areas on the surface or within the atmosphere.
Right.
In planetary and climate science, we're often referring to ice coverage when we talk about albedo. This is something that you may actually encounter if you're reading the news about new climate science and about ice melt. Actually, as ice melts, the albedo actually goes up because more and more dirt and dust and things mix in with that pure white ice and it becomes darker in color. In physics, though, it has a pretty different definition, but I think it actually did evolve from that original definition, which is the probability that a neutron passing through a surface will return through that surface. So here it's kind of similar, but they're talking about neutrons and not actually photons or visible light packets. And then randomly, another definition of albedo that I found, because I want to be exhaustive here, is the white inner rind of a citrus fruit. Because, sure.
Sure.
Okay. So what you're seeing there is that there's a common theme. And Evan, you hit on it right at the beginning when you said albino.
Well, there you go.
Right? White.
Yes, white.
The term albedo actually comes from the Latin, which means whiteness, from albus, which means white, like egg albumen is white. Now, a lot of sources link the first usage to 1859, but I found another source, actually a fun word blog called the Sesquiotica blog. I really hope I'm pronouncing that right. The Sesquiotica blog, which cites an even earlier incident. There they credit it to Johann Heinrich Lambert in 1790 was the first usage there of albedo, referring to that reflective state.
All right. I have to ask you a couple of trivia questions.
Oh,
which planet in the solar system has the highest albedo?
Is it Venus?
Venus. Very good. What's the albedo?
Oh, I don't know.
0.8.
Like 4?
0.75.
0.75. Yes. Oh, 0.75. That's high. Okay.
What's the body in the solar system with the highest albedo?
Our moon.
One of the moons? Someone's moon.
It is someone's moon. Which moon is it?
Io. Europa.
Enceladus.
Is it Europa?
Titan.
Enceladus, Ganymede, Europa, Enceladus, Io.
Right.
Kara, you were right the first time. Enceladus.
Enceladus, yay! I don't
know
why Rachel, I knew that.
That's my daughter Rachel's favorite moon, by the way.
0.95.
It's almost one.
Almost.
Wow.
It's almost one.
It's super reflective. So it would like you'd have to wear sunglasses to look at this moon.
All right. I like that word, Kara.
It's a good one, right?
Albedo. Yeah. It's a good concept to know.
I feel like we could use it a lot.
We have a few emails we can get to. We'll see how far we get.
Right.
First one comes from Kevin. Did you guys see Cabin in the Woods?
No,
of course.
It was amazing.
It was epic.
One of the monsters was Kevin. You remember that?
Awesome.
Kevin writes, I am interested in what your opinion is of skeptics using hoaxes and what are the ethical considerations skeptics should be aware of when conducting experiments and investigations.
Mm-hmm.
This question is for the podcast. He says, stay skeptical. Thank you, Kevin. That's a good question. That comes up every now and then.
Right. I assume he means creating hoaxes.
Yes, creating hoaxes.
In order to drive home the skeptical point of view.
It's too risky. Too risky.
Yeah.
Come back and bite you in the ass.
It often backfires.
There's a couple of good reasons not to do it, not to try to pull off a hoax. One is, as Bob and Evan say, it's very risky. It's hard to pull off well. Jamie Ian Swiss made the point when this topic came up, we were talking about it. He said, you know, so James Randi, yes, he's done a couple over his career, but you know, he is an expert in deception. He's a magician, a professional magician, and he's only done it a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Carlos.
You know, yeah.
Carlos and
The Alpha Project
are the two prominent ones. You know, he's very, very cautious about it. So if you're going to do a sting operation or try to actually pull off a hoax in order to reveal the gullibility of the media or whatever your goal is, you know, it's very high risk. You probably shouldn't do it. The other reason, however, I think is even more compelling than that. Even if you can pull it off, there's a good reason not to do that. And that is, I think as skeptics, we need to be completely honest agents of information.
Transparent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you sacrifice your own credibility by doing that. So, like, for example, I happened to find myself in the middle of a lawsuit giving testimony in a court of law. I certainly wouldn't want the other attorney to say, isn't it true that you lied to the media and pulled off a hoax at some point? Because that would be, a actually reasonable point, I think, against someone's credibility. It's good to say that you're an honest broker of information. You'll never lie or try to engage in a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's valuable. I would not surrender that lightly. And honestly, that's how I've seen them play out in terms of the court of public opinion. Even as good as Randy is, and as much as I think as he pulled off his events, a lot of people use that against him. Randy was a liar.
Right, liar.
He pulled off these deceptions. So I don't see what the gain is. Let me not say that. The hope is that you'll expose the failure of a process or a gullibility that can have a certain advantage. There's a couple of cases where, for example, scientists published a hoax article in a journal just to expose their lack of peer review, for example, or journalistic standards. But they exposed it at the same time. That's a little different. Mm-hmm. Like Sokol, remember Alan Sokol did that?
Sure.
That's a little bit closer to the line. I think that may be reasonable because you're actually exposing it at the exact same time. There's no point at which you are deceiving the public at large. The only people you deceived are the targets, the journal editors who shouldn't have been deceived. And I think that the benefit there is probably worth the deception and the process itself. Generally speaking, I wouldn't do it. And it comes up every now and then. People suggest, hey, let's make our own crop circle and see if the media buys it. It's like, oh, I wouldn't mind making one, but I would do it transparently.
Yeah, because you also have to be really prepared.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who haven't been in the media that often, or who, they don't, it's a lot to have a lot of attention on you very quickly.
Yeah.
It's a lot to handle. It's a lot to always be above board and always say exactly what you mean. You'll see very quickly how much journalists will, misquote, or you'll be saying one thing and it'll come out differently. And it's a lot of responsibility you have to the public, and also just a lot of stress you're kind of inviting onto yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, another point that I think we need to drive home a little bit more. I mean, you could pull it off very well. It's very successful. And the people that you expose are shown to be, for what they are. But still, 5 years later, what you did can then become part of the database of information that pseudoscientists pull from to show an example of whatever pseudoscience that they're supporting.
Right.
And you could say, hey, no, I did that. I made that up. That's a fake. It won't matter. There could still be literally millions of people that believe what happened was a real thing.
Doug and Dave created the modern crop circle phenomenon as a hoax. And then they later confessed, and nobody believes that the believers reject their confession.
Yes.
And that's say, right. No, it's really aliens. And that was out of their control. They've lost control of that phenomenon.
Yeah.
This is when Randy goes on The Tonight Show, does psychic surgery. It shows how it's done, basically exposing it as a total sham. And guess what? People call up NBC to find out how they can get a hold of a psychic surgeon.
Yeah. Now, Kevin mentions experiments. So it is ethical to use deception when conducting an experiment. Like if you're doing a psychological experiment, you almost have to use deception. But there are very specific ethical protocols in place. You have to do an exit interview where you explain everything that was going on to the subjects of your experiment and make sure that you essentially deal with the deception that was inherent in the study. Bottom line, don't do it unless you're a professional, and even then, think very carefully about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on. Question number two comes from Joel Anderson from Detroit, Michigan. Did you guys know that Detroit was originally called Detroit?
Why? Sure, why not?
Because it's a French name.
Yeah, of course.
It's very worldly.
Holy crap.
We Americanized it to Detroit.
Ugh.
I wonder if it would have a different vibe if it was still Detroit.
Detroit instead of Detroit.
Detroit.
Yeah. Okay.
It means Joel writes, three.
Hi, everybody. Love the show. As I listened to show number 540, I heard the item in science fiction about meds degrading in microgravity. This brought to mind one of my many all-time favorite failures in science education, that being the answer to the question, why do astronauts float in space, for example, at the space station? I've asked dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of people from all walks of life and educational backgrounds, and I have only had one correct answer. Wow. I wanted to ask your opinion. If you think use of the term microgravity, which implies little or to no gravity, instead of weightlessness is incorrect or misleading. I think science education is important but extremely difficult, and the words used are critical. I'm also curious about your thoughts as to why nobody knows why the astronauts float. Is it because of words like this, or is the answer just too difficult to convey to the herd? Thank you for your work, Joel. So what do you guys think about that?
I see three major questions here. The first one, why do astronauts float? For example, in the space station, they float. The astronauts and the space station seem to float because they are in orbit. They are in free fall, essentially, which means they're essentially falling around the Earth. And the best way to describe that, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around it a little bit. How do you fall around the Earth? Why don't you just hit the Earth? And the reason why is because of your extreme velocity essentially causes the Earth's curve to drop away from them at the same rate that you fall to the Earth. So you pretty much stay at the same altitude because of that reason. So that's my take on why astronauts float in space. Steve, is there anything you would add to that? Or
No, it's just they're in orbit. That's it. They're in free fall.
But that is a really good explanation of like that every time you fall, it moves just that much to the left. Or you know what I mean? That
exactly.
Those two measurements are lined up just perfectly, and that's how you stay in orbit.
Well, the best visualization I heard, and I learned this a long time ago.
The cannonball?
Yeah, it's the cannonball or the baseball or whatever. So you know, let's say you're on a very, very tall tower and you throw a baseball, and you could follow the arc of the baseball as it falls to the ground. And they say you throw it harder and harder, it goes farther and farther. Eventually, you throw it so hard that it never gets any closer to the Earth. It just falls around the Earth and keeps going forever. And that's orbit. That's orbital velocity. You throw it fast enough. Yeah.
The planets are falling towards the sun, right?
Yeah. So the planets are free fall around the sun. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
All right. The next one is a little bit trickier. He says, he asks if we think the term microgravity, which implies little or to no gravity, instead of weightlessness, is incorrect or misleading. I think microgravity is clearly misleading. It's a misnomer because it implies a small force of gravity. When in actuality, if you're on the space station, the force of gravity is about 88 to 90% of what the force is on the Earth's surface. There's nothing micro about that. So I think it's definitely misleading. Now, whether it's
my sense of why that term came into use,
I know exactly
was because
why
because it's not exactly zero. The force of gravity that's being felt is not exactly zero. So they wanted to distinguish zero gravity from microgravity, but that then introduced a term that creates a misconception.
Because also you've got to compare the difference between what the actual gravitational force is and what the kind of actor is feeling.
Yeah. It's what's
that's
being experienced.
Difference.
That's part of it. But Steve, some of your terminology I don't think was correct. I think the intention of the term microgravity is correct if you know where it came about. But it has been bastardized, which makes the common interpretation incorrect. So this is how it came about. The forces that pilots feel are described as a G-force, which is a small g. This is the G from physics for the acceleration of gravity. G-force. We've all heard of G-force. One G means that you feel as heavy as you do on Earth. 2 G's, you feel twice as heavy. 50 G's, and you're probably dead. 0 G's means that you don't feel weight at all. So technically, the force you feel is not exactly 0 G's, though, because of the tidal forces that you're experiencing because you're so near to Earth. You know, they impart these tiny accelerations on different parts of your body. So NASA wanted to be very accurate, so they didn't want to call it 0 G, so they called it micro G's. It was not microgravity. Yeah. It was micro G. So you were experiencing micro G's. It's not that you're feeling minimal gravity because you are exposed to almost the full brunt of gravity, but your experience of gravity, of this feeling of weight is micro G's. It's not zero G. So then that changed to micro G, then microgravity. So that's kind of how it morphed into this, into this misnomer. So that's what really happened there. So if you wanted to kind of, change that word as much as you can, you could say, that the astronauts, experience micro G forces of space. That would be better. But I think if you want a really good term that's accurate and easy to understand, then it would be something like the free fall weightlessness would be a good way to do it. Cause that's really what it is. It's mm-hmm. you're in free fall and you're going to feel weightless.
Isn't this where so many problems come to pass? Like, I feel like that's why when I used to teach introductory biology, like 101 and psych 101, the first thing you learn is always use units. Mm-hmm. Units confuse people. If you don't know, like, that is two. You're like, two what, kids?
Yeah, that's right.
2 grams?
That helps.
2 kilos? It helps. And the more that you can identify what those units are, because to us, a lot of times we see just numbers with letters next to them. And this is a mm-hmm. perfect example of that. Identifying what that unit really means at its core definition, that a G is different than the actual force of gravity, is probably something that so many people just gloss over and haven't taken the time to think about.
Now, to extend that a little bit more, so if you wanted to experience zero G's, you would need to be deep enough in space that the tidal forces would be essentially zero or completely negligible. So that would be tough, though, when you're really close to anything with any type of any type of gravity well. Now, zero G, though, zero gravity, that's impossible. Technically, you can never experience zero gravity, because wherever you are in the universe, I don't care where you are, there's going to be mm-hmm. some force of gravity that will be affecting you, even in some minutely minimal way. It's never going to totally reach zero. Yeah. I guess it would be some asymptotic value, but so that's my take on all that.
So yes, the term is misleading, but it's inadvertent because they were going for micro G, which got bastardized into microgravity, which creates the misconception.
Right. Yeah. So the last question he's talking about, I'm also curious about your thoughts as to why nobody knows why the astronauts float. Is it because the words like this, or is the answer just too difficult to convey to the herd? Now, I don't think it's too difficult to convey, especially if you've got a good description or even a good animation of what's going on with the cannon going off. I think you could easily convey that to almost anybody.
Pretty much everyone gets exposed to that in grade school.
Maybe these days.
Or this idea of orbital?
This idea of, yeah.
Yeah, but in terms of actually making them understand, really, really understand this without needing to go anywhere just by reading or seeing, I think words like this can definitely contribute to a misunderstanding. Plus, also, don't forget the way this type of thing is represented in movies and TV. I remember in I Dream of Jeannie, they had a zero gravity room. You would go into a specific place in the room and you would just float there. It was really silly.
So they movies don't exist.
Movies and TV can contribute. Plus, I don't think we can discount the whole idea of just a general lack of motivation and interest in people to understand exactly what's happening. So I think all of these things contribute. And as to what their relative contributions are, I don't know.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Guys, ready for this week?
I'm never ready.
You don't have Jay to guide you this week. You'll have to just soldier on without him.
Oh, I think no. I'll manage.
I've Here they go. Not been listening to Jay.
is it about Thanksgiving or teeth or Star Wars?
Or Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln.
We'll all get it wrong.
You hit upon Jay's 3 areas of expertise. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, here we go. Item number 1. A new study finds that pigeons are able to categorize digitized slides of mammograms of benign and malignant human breast tissue, as well as highly trained humans.
What?
Item number 2, an NIH survey finds that 10% of American adults have a drug addiction problem at some point in their lives. And item number 3, astronomers have found a distant galaxy supercluster that appears to be completely devoid of dark matter. Evan, go first.
Pigeons are able to categorize digitized slides and mammograms.
Yes, these are pathology slides and mammogram pictures.
I see.
They're able to tell which ones are cancer and which ones are benign.
Pigeons. Why? What's special about pigeons that they could do this? It may have something to do with their with the extra cones and rods, maybe in their eyes. Perhaps they are seeing something there in the spectrum that we otherwise cannot see. Birds can do that, although I'm not quite sure why. Pigeons, maybe because they're more agreeable than other birds, as well as highly trained humans. I don't know. Don't know about that one. Next one. There's a survey. 10% of American adults have a drug addiction at some point in their lives. 10%. Well, drug addictions come in many forms. It's not just the illicit ones. There are other drugs. There is caffeine. There is tobacco. There are others.
Now, this doesn't count caffeine and tobacco. This is alcohol, marijuana, heroin, cocaine, those drugs.
Okay, like so vice
diagnosable.
Drugs.
Yeah, diagnosable okay. drug addiction. Okay. Yeah.
That could be right. I don't know if we're going to take into consideration, say, mothers who are giving birth to children, and if the mothers have some sort of addiction, does that mean technically the fetus inside of them? I don't know. Maybe they're counting that somehow.
The adults. Know. Read the question. Adults.
Thank you.
Read the
I skipped
question.
Over the word adult. American adults have a drug addiction.
This is like
point.
A fascinating
at some point
glimpse
in their
into
life.
Your brain, Evan.
Well, this one, at some point in their lives, after having become adults.
Yes, as an adult.
Thank you. Okay. Right. All right. Don't know about that one either. And then they found a distant galaxy, supercluster. It appears to be completely devoid of dark matter. Well, this one of the three, I think, is the most feasible one. The key word here is appears to be completely devoid of dark matter. All right, American adults, drug addiction, 10%. Something's not right there, and I can't put my finger on it, but I'll say that that's the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a pigeon seeing a frequency of light or anything that humans can't see. I just think it's a very specific type of, say, pattern recognition that for some reason pigeons would have that would let them perform so well. So, yeah, I can kind of see that. That sounds like a reasonable way to interpret that. The 10% of American adults experiencing drug addiction. Yeah, that seems like a reasonable number. So I don't have too much of a problem with that one. The big problem I have is with this distant galaxy supercluster. No dark matter. I have a hard time with that. I mean, dark matter is the organizing principle around the universe. I mean, all the galaxies and especially the superclusters are pretty much organizing themselves around the dark matter. So I can't imagine a galaxy, let alone a supercluster, not having any dark matter. So what would that mean then? Would that mean then that the rotation of the galaxy would be uneven? Because right now, every galaxy that I'm aware of that we've seen rotates at the outskirts of the galaxy as the inside of the galaxy.
That's what it would mean.
So yeah, so that would mean that they would orbit, I don't know, either the galaxy would fly apart or the rotations would be really unlike any other galaxy. And to see that effect throughout an entire supercluster seems way too extreme for me. I mean, maybe they could have found potentially a dwarf galaxy that had very little. I would buy that much more than a supercluster. So I'm going to say that one's fiction.
And Kara.
Although Bob has led me astray before,
I am sort of
feeling him on this one because, you know, I don't know as much about dark matter, dark energy as I'd like to. I saw a cool planetarium show about it at the
American
wasn't
that awesome?
Museum of Natural History. Yeah,
it's
with
very dark.
Dyson.
It was very dark. The imagery was gorgeous. Oh my God, so beautiful.
I know that I learned that something like 95% of the universe is made up of dark energy and dark matter combined. I don't know how to parse out those percentages, but I definitely know it's a lot. So it seems crazy to me that like a whole galaxy or a supercluster of galaxies, I think that's what that means, wouldn't have any dark matter in it. So to me, that sounds crazy. So that's the one I'm like initially leaning towards, but I'll go through the other two quickly. Pigeons are very good at pattern recognition. I've known this for a long time. I would not be surprised if there was something very specific in benign versus malignant tumors, like in terms of their shape or in terms of their, you know, morphology that a pigeon could recognize, especially if it was trained with juice or whatever pigeons like to eat, seeds. The other one that's sort of sticking in my side, though, is the NIH survey, mostly because of the language here, drug addiction. I know that my past experience with the DSM usually talked about use, abuse, and dependence, and maybe addiction encompasses that. I don't know. It's a little bit foggy, the difference between drug use and drug dependence. I'm going to say that addiction is an umbrella term here. And if that's the case, 10% seems like a realistic number to me. But if addiction only specifically means dependence and not like use and abuse disorders, I don't know. Ooh. But I'm going to lean towards, I'm going to side with Bob on this one. I'm going to say that there's nothing out there that doesn't have dark matter, at least as far as we know.
Okay. So you all agree that a new study finds that pigeons are able to categorize digitized slides and mammograms of benign and malignant human breast tissue as well as highly trained humans. You all think that's science, and that one is science.
Yeah, yes.
By the way, is crazy.
It's crazy.
Like, it's absolutely crazy.
It's like the chicken that wins at tic-tac-toe in New York.
It's very much not like time. That because that's
yeah,
crazy.
But now he's,
So they trained these pigeons with good old operant conditioning to recognize benign versus pathological.
Oh, they trained them.
Yeah, of course. Pathologist
pick up
mammogram pictures.
Pigeons off the sidewalk, Bob, and throw a bunch of pictures in front.
I thought they would have some like natural affinity for it, which I guess they clearly have some sort of natural affinity if they can do it.
Learned pattern recognition with behaviorally reinforced. And after 10 to 15 days of conditioning, they were able to get as good as like radiologists, trained people.
That's
they got
awesome.
Very good. Here's the crazy thing. In one study, they looked at the aggregate performance of four pigeons. They called that flock sourcing, right? Instead of crowdsourcing.
Crowdsourcing, flock sourcing.
Yeah. Oh my God. Nice.
And with flock sourcing, they got 99% correct.
Whew. Margin of error. Come on. That's impressive.
That's impressive.
Damn impressive.
You could replace a radiologist with four pigeons.
That's great.
Damn.
The radiologist lobbies are nuts right now.
Yeah, I just interviewed a radiologist on the podcast. She's actually one of my best friends. She's going to be very sad to hear you say that.
This was even black and white. So they wanted to eliminate color vision as a variable. And even in black and white, they did very well. But humans and birds did better with color. The birds were particularly good at identifying microcalcifications, which can be a sign of pathology. There was one thing, though, that they couldn't do.
Bill for their services.
Yeah.
They weren't good at identifying tissue density on the mammograms.
Oh, stupid birds.
It was too subtle.
It's my density.
My density.
Back to the Future.
Just reflects. Birds, even though they have very tiny brains compared to humans, they are very adept at visual pattern recognition. They have the neurons dedicated to that specific kind of processing.
Yeah. I wonder what else they'll be able to find.
Yeah.
To test them for all sorts of stuff.
So, could actually be used as sort of an adjunct, I guess, to
Nurse,
people.
Bring in the pigeon.
Can you imagine? Read your x-ray. Oh my God.
But it's funny. I did a story once on dogs that sniff a compound in cancer haven't been able to identify yet. But that, it is funny how animals sometimes do have these abilities. This is obviously different because we're training them to find it. Actually, no, you train them to find it in dogs too. Yeah. And the animal ability could lead the way to make an artificial nose, quote unquote, to find that compound, which hasn't yet been described. That's cool.
Now, Steve, what about using an automated, computer-based process to spot these things on a mammogram? Can't they do very well as well?
Sure. You could use computer algorithms to flag, and to draw your attention to it. But just people are still better at pattern recognition than even the computers. You still need the human in the loop at the end of the day.
Or a pigeon.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, let's go on to number two. An NIH survey finds that 10% of American adults have a drug addiction at some point in their lives. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Kara think this one is science. And this one is... Science.
Yeah, baby. Kara,
Woo!
So, this was based on DSM-5 criteria, Kara.
Gotcha.
So, 10%.
I haven't read the new one.
Yeah. So the drugs included include amphetamines, marijuana, club drugs, cocaine, hallucinogens, heroin, non-heroin opioids, sedative, tranquilizers, solvents, inhalants. It's a long
huffing,
list.
Huffing, baby.
And yeah, they met diagnostic criteria for actual addiction. They said at any point in time, about 4% of Americans meet criteria for an addiction, but or at some point in their adult life, as many as 10%. That's a lot. 1 in 10 people at some point have an addiction. That's a lot.
I'm not surprised. I mean, I feel like we really have a culture that does not recognize it the way that it should.
It's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you get what's called a dual diagnosis. If you have alcohol problem, for example, and you also have depression or anxiety or some other mental illness, they are multiplied. You know, they really magnify each other. It becomes so much harder to address the mental illness when you have an addiction problem layered on top of it. And of course, it's not uncommon because sometimes people, for example, will self-medicate. You know, they'll treat their depression with alcohol, and of course that just makes it worse.
And that's kind of a new way that some psychiatrists and psychologists are actually looking at addiction research, is what is this underlying distress signal that these individuals are experiencing that's leading to the addiction.
All right, all of this means that astronomers have found a distant galaxy supercluster that appears to be completely devoid of dark matter is complete and utter bollocks, because made that up. But I was inspired by a real news item. In fact, astronomers have recently discovered, possibly, this hasn't been totally verified yet, but one observer has discovered that a dwarf galaxy that is close to the Milky Way, the Triangulum Galaxy, Triangulum 2.
Heard of that one?
Yeah, it's a small, faint dwarf galaxy that, according to his measurements, the astronomer's measurements, using the Keck telescope, there is a very high density of dark matter in the galaxy, perhaps the densest dark matter of any galaxy observed. Now, it would be an awful coincidence if that just happened to be our next-door neighbor. So I suspect, there's an artifact in there somewhere. But that was the news item. I didn't want to use it as a real one because it's not verified. It's one astronomer.
Right.
Reasons why that may not be accurate. But apparently, if these observations hold up, it might be a particularly dense, dark matter, dense dwarf galaxy. So I was going to use as the fiction that astronomers have discovered a galaxy without any dark matter. But as I usually do, I looked it up to make sure it was actually fiction.
It's not?
It's not.
No, so, dark matter.
Galaxy NGC 4736.
What?
4736?
That's what got me confused.
That one?
Yeah, which is also called Messier 94.
Right.
It's a beautiful face-on spiral galaxy.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And so we can measure the motion of its stars, and it doesn't follow the usual pattern. The stars get slower as you get farther from the core instead of having a fairly uniform velocity. And according to the existing measurements, there's little or no dark matter in this galaxy.
That's a surprise to me. Wow, that's fascinating.
That was found in 2006, and I couldn't find any update. I checked. There's a Wikipedia page about this galaxy. Doesn't contain any update. There's no apparent update that contradicts that. So that's still...
But if it's face on, how do you determine radial velocity? Because there really is not much radial velocity at all.
There's no Doppler shift from the stars coming at us
away from us. Yeah, no, it would have all radial velocity, but no tangential velocity.
Tangential velocity. I don't think this is fully accepted by the astronomical community. It sounds like there's still some skepticism about whether or not it's true that this galaxy lacks any dark matter. But that is, at the moment, that's the prevailing evidence. Now, of course, if that holds up, that's a conundrum because it's not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Dark matter is supposed to be what organizes galaxies. So how could you have a galaxy? We don't know how you can have a galaxy without dark matter. And of course, if you're still one of those people who subscribe to modified Newtonian dynamics, there's no way to explain it, you know, based upon MOND.
Right.
You have to invoke something else entirely. So something interesting happened to this galaxy or is going on with this galaxy, or there's some error in the current measurements that will need to get fixed.
So yeah, but so Steve, what about the bullet? Is it maybe it's like the bullet cluster where there was wasn't there some sort of collision and the dark matter kept going and the cluster kind right. of didn't? So I wonder if there's a cluster of dark matter that's kind of nearby that's kind of just like separated from the galaxy. But how the hell would that? And that would no, that would distort. That would distort
yeah,
the galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. But with the bullet cluster, it's obvious that it collided. You know, with something.
Yeah.
So it, this is
that's
a,
why it's called
this
a cluster.
Is a pristine spiral galaxy. It's you know. Does not appear to have collided with anything else. So,
Evan, you and I are really quiet right now.
Something yeah. odd's going on with Messier 94. So, I love mysteries.
Yeah, I suspect that that's a measurement error, especially since you can't find anything else since then. Because that would be big if they either confirmed it or even refuted it. I don't know.
Well, they have. It hasn't been refuted, you know, since the study came out. So we'll see. That's definitely one to keep on my list of things to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good job, Bob and Kara.
Yay.
Thank you.
I didn't miss you, Kara.
Do people keep track of this for us?
Oh,
yes. Multiple people.
So speaking of which, it's mid-November, which means we're just about a month away from recording our end-of-the-year wrap-up episode. This will be your first one with us, Kara. We go over...
Yeah.
The past year, all the highlights of the past year, statistics for the previous year. So we, at this time of year, we ask our listeners to send us in an email and email us your favorite episode, interview, funniest thing that happened this year, your favorite news item, the most skeptical thing that happened this year, the worst pseudoscientist of the year. And then we will gather all that together and talk about it at the end of the year wrap up show. And we'll also go over our science or fiction statistics. All right, Evan, take us home with a quote.
Learning is not attained by chance. It must be sought for with ardor and attended to with diligence. That was spoken by Abigail Adams, or written by Abigail Adams, I should say. Abigail Adams being the wife of President John Adams, second president of the United States. And what she is saying is that, look, you're going to learn. You have to do it. You have to roll up your sleeves and get in there and learn. We were talking earlier in the show about people who are not Psy curious. And you can go ahead and be like that in life. You're not going to learn much of anything of good use to kind of help you out.
I think you could probably occasionally learn something by chance, but
sure, yeah, by chance, maybe.
But certainly working at it is better.
Working at it is better, and there's also a way to learn how to learn, how to become better at learning, more. How should I put it? More not sophisticated.
Erudite?
I guess it could be erudite. More
perspicacious.
Inarticulate?
Yes, that's it. Thank you, Steve. Yes, I must learn. Yes, more learning, including myself.
Learning good.
Learning good. Fire warm.
Yeah, I often remind my daughters of that fact when they're complaining about the perceived worthlessness of something they're studying in school. I tell them, you know, the most important thing you're learning right now is how to learn. It's how to be a good student. That those generic skills are the most important thing you're learning, not the necessarily each little fact that you're learning.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.